This is...
Wow!
What a week.
What a week. Celebrity guest.
Celebrity guest.
There are some guests who will be recognized by different avenues. Some will say, hey, he's the guy from Carte Blanche. Some will say, he sounds like that guy from 702. Some, more mature viewers, will ponder, he looks like he was on KTV, which will lead some less mature viewers to ask, what the hell is KTV? Whatever your reference is, you'll agree he's been a notable feature in the SA media landscape for quite a while. Please give a warm welcome to Bongani, Uncle Bongani, Bongles, Bingwa. Bongles. How you doing, my dog?
I'm well. Firstly, I have to correct you. It wasn't mini TV. It wasn't KTV. It was mini TV.
Oh, mini TV.
And mini TV was set up to try and do what KTV
was doing.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
On the old TV1.
I remember. The previous CCV.
Was CCV was the previous TV2.
Oh, it was the TV2.
Yeah.
How old are you? You're turning 50 this year.
I am.
What are you looking forward to about 50? Based on what your perceptions of 40 were, and that you've now done 10 years of 40s, what are you looking forward to about the 50s?
I'm looking forward to being younger and older at the same time.
Okay.
My father, when he was my age, was a considerably older man.
Yes.
Perhaps he was also wiser, but yes, he was considerably older man than I am in terms of his physical appearance, his demeanor, his perspective of the world. Mm. And I think what we are learning as our generation, we are younger at 50, but because we're more open to the world and how it's changing, I think we're wiser.
I was reading a meme the other day. Someone posted it. He's in his 40s. He's like, guys, so we are the adults now? Who trusted us to be the adults?
We get called into the meetings. We get to make the decisions.
You're the uncle now.
I am the uncle. I'm so a lot of my nephews and nieces who already have kids.
Yes.
Call me Tatomkhulu.
Exactly.
You know, as in the grandfather.
Absolutely.
It's insane.
How wild is that? But also the fact that we're still young at heart, we even look younger.
We dress younger, we speak younger, we think younger, we eat younger, we listen younger, we party younger.
Some are even dating younger.
As you must if you're single at 50. It's the one perk you get. To get to 50 and be single, it is the one perk you get. Because everybody else your age.
Yes.
You, of course, are always the exception to this rule. Mm-hmm. But everybody else your age has got a whole lot going on that you don't want.
Absolutely.
At 50.
Absolutely. Now, when I asked you to come have a chat with me on Wow, What a Week, the first thing you said was, why? Why would you say that?
Because my whole career has been around the people I interview.
Sure.
They are the story.
Sure.
I have worked very hard to not be the story. Mm. And I always used to point to Derek Watts as an example of this.
Sure.
When he appeared on your television screen on a Sunday night, if he said anything, you trusted it, you believed it, because he said it.
Sure.
But who he was on Monday morning, on Tuesday afternoon, on Thursday evening, you really didn't care. He was never the story.
And we had no clue also.
Precisely. Mm. You know, and he was just the trusted voice of broadcast news.
Mm.
And that's what I've tried to do with my life.
Sure.
And so I thought, have you run out of guests? A year into it already.
The thing is, majority of the guests that I interview are people who I'm a fan of their work, of their minds, or of what they do. And because I'm a fan of your shows, and because I've been a fan of yours since you were on Channel O, because I never watched mini TV, because I think by the time mini TV hit, I was either at boarding school or at varsity. So I've been a fan of your work since the Channel O times. And I almost feel like we grew pretty much at the same time, parallel in the industry. Because as Channel O was this brand new baby on TV, YFM was the brand new baby on radio. And then Simunye was also this new kid. So I almost feel like we're a generation that reshaped what youth culture was.
In fact, in 1999, Channel O went on its first nationwide tour.
Sure.
And there was a house CD.
Yes.
That had
that kept who, you guys
That had
busy.
Who?
Yeah.
As part of the talent on it?
Absolutely.
DJ Fresh.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you may remember that, of
Absolutely.
Course.
Absolutely. How would you say those brands reshaped what youth culture became, looking back in hindsight?
It was a seminal moment in our history. I think let's firstly put it in that context because Channel O comes on stream 3 years after 1994, after democracy.
Sure.
There was this sense of anything was possible.
Mm.
We were that first, and we were lucky in a sense because we were old enough to remember the sting of apartheid, the limits of apartheid.
Yes.
But we were young enough to be part of everything that was new. So there was this explosion of culture. Whether you're looking at Kwaito, whether you're looking at fashion, there were these groups that were coming out of nowhere, the Bongo Muffins of this world. If you think about what Lebu and Tembi and those guys were doing, it was just this explosion of youth, of exuberance, of hope, of a tomorrow that had arrived.
Looking back, do you think we fully grasped the responsibility we had on our shoulders? Let me tell you why I'm asking this. Because often people ask me about my time at YFM, and it's only now that I realize, one, how much we shaped the popular culture, but also, two, how much of it we were not in the moment for. Because we were on the wave, we didn't fully appreciate the fish and everything else under the wave and the nuance and just everything else that was happening.
Who does? Who does appreciate that kind of explosion? Because the uniqueness of the moment means it's likely not going to be repeated within our lifetime.
Absolutely.
Certainly within, you know, the generation that we are now still a part of. So you don't get a sense of that moment because you when you're a pioneer, there's a lot of you doing things that you're not supposed to do in the first place. You're doing things that many people would bet against succeeding.
Yeah.
I mean, Channel O was meant to be this pan-African music channel that was about bringing all of the music genres that people, young people, were listening to all over the continent together. Who had ever done that?
And you know, before Channel O, there was only one music show that catered for the continent. It was called Rock Down Africa. And it was presented by those two twins from Nigeria. I'm trying to remember their names. Pretty boys, very hunky dudes. But it was a show on Mnet. That was the only music show that catered for the entire continent.
Now, that you know that because you had a decoder.
Also because I did the voiceover as a student on a budget, but I didn't have Mnet.
but I mean, Channel O took me to Nigeria for the first time, took me to Kenya for the first time. And those were experiences I would never have had otherwise.
Yeah.
I will never forget being in Abuja, in the red light district, or at least an area of the capital that we were told was the red light district. And there was a Muslim woman who had hidden her face, dressed very modestly. And I thought, this is the biggest contradiction I have ever seen. But we were told that's exactly what the local Muslim men needed from that kind of service. They still needed some veneer of modesty, even if it wasn't there. Those were things a guy from Mthatha in the Eastern Cape would never have been able to see, but for that coming together of that moment.
Absolutely. Memories of Mthatha, while were they? What are some of your fond memories?
It's such a contradiction.
Yeah.
Because my father and his friends were lawyers, were doctors, were accountants. Many of them were the firsts in their families.
Yes.
But some of them came from generations of people who'd been educated in mission schools, who'd gone to the Lovedales, the Healdtowns, Forte University, obviously. And they lived in this bubble of what the Bantustans could actually afford. They knew it was a false economy. They knew it was a false reality. But at the same time, they prized education intensely. And for many of them, going to do the struggle, skipping the country, was seen as something you did if you couldn't succeed in the real world. And yet at the same time, they were entirely dependent on what the struggle would do to free them from their own complicity with the system. So they lived with this guilt And yet at the same time, they built these bubbles.
Sure.
And there was a lot of, I'm being inarticulate, but there was a lot of alcohol abuse. Mm. There was a lot of philandering.
A lot of excess.
A lot of excess because they needed something to assuage their guilty consciences. Sure. But here you and I are sitting. I'm a result of that philandering.
Mm. 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 And how do you reconcile that with where you are now?
Each generation is called to rise up and do something that hopefully will live beyond their time, beyond their moment.
Mm.
We're all part of the tapestry of history.
Sure.
And without sounding too philosophical, they did what they knew to do with what they had.
Sure. Did your pops also drive a 230 Mercedes?
So the first Mercedes I ever drove, I had a personalized number plate.
Shut up.
In homage to him.
Yes.
Because I used his clan name. I used to have a car called Lambulo GP.
Oh, wow.
I'm over it now.
Yeah.
3 cars later, I still battle to remember my license plate.
Yeah.
Because of that. But yeah, absolutely, that's it. One of my mother's business associates had a car phone.
Yeah.
Like we saw J.R. Ewing.
Exactly.
You know, that was a thing.
I remember growing up, my girlfriend's uncle had a car phone. I was like, you're the only car in Haburoni with a car phone. Who are you calling?
But they did. And who was calling them, importantly?
Exactly. I was like, maybe black folk didn't deserve money in the 80s.
But again, I think it was that aspirational thing where there were so many avenues closed to black people.
Sure.
That where you could find some kind of niche, if you were an entrepreneur, if you owned a number of, you know, service stations or a KFC, and you sort of could throw your weight around in a small town, those were the only avenues of really full self-expression.
Isn't the big irony, though, that a lot of the kids of those men and women from the 80s were also into boarding school, away from the Eastern Cape?
A lot of people were, because you must also remember that people from Johannesburg, people from Cape Town, from Port Elizabeth, because of the unrest that really flowed from 76 onwards, they would send their kids to the schools of certainly Transkei in particular.
Sure.
And so, I mean, you know, classism is always about trying to do one step better.
Mm.
So a lot of these people would be able to send their kids to the St. Andrews in Grahamstown or Michael House in KZN, etc.
Yeah, we had 3 kids from the Transkei in our boarding school.
And we in the Transkei, by the way, had these images of what we thought Soweto was or what we thought New Brighton was in PE.
Mm.
And it was quite extraordinary how we essentially lived this very suburban life in the 80s.
Absolutely.
The music I listened to were Wham, Prince, Bruce Springsteen, George Michael, Michael Jackson, of course.
Every artist you've mentioned there, I played at the school disco as the school DJ.
Tears for Fears.
I
mean, of course, there was lots of sort of R&B and black music.
Yes,
I mean,
Brenda Fassie township at the music. Time, Steamella at the time.
Blondie, right?
Yes.
And do you remember Overtime?
Yes.
When Blondie went solo, all of that stuff was part of that mix.
Mm.
But we were suburban kids. We were cheese boys.
Absolutely.
Before anybody had even coined the expression.
Absolutely. You moved to Johannesburg because what happened?
It's the most apartheid. Ultimately, was just an absurd idea.
Mm.
When we moved to Johannesburg, my mother wanted to try and do business here.
Sure.
So they had meetings at places like the Carlton Hotel or the Johannesburg Sun. They used to have training sessions at the Mill Park Holiday
Inn. So this is in the 80s,
this is 1986, the height of apartheid.
Yeah.
Yes, things were starting to loosen a little.
Yeah.
But if you think of Berea or even Hillbra. Mm.
Or Joubert Park.
Think of Killarney today.
Yes. Yeah.
The first exclusive bookstore in the country was in Hillbra.
Mm.
I used to spend hours at Look and Listen Records in Hillbra at that corner there next to...
On Pretoria Street.
At that corner next to Garbers.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Hillbra Records.
Yeah.
The movies, the New Metro, the Stir Kinnickle, the first time I ever went to the movies,
High
all
Point.
Of that was in Hillbra. We lived in High Point.
Yeah.
All the celebrities.
Yeah.
that I would see on television, whether it was music or television presenters or actors, they all lived
High Point.
At
yeah.
High Point.
Yeah.
So that was the context. But how did we live at High Point? My mother knew somebody who worked at the Trans Guy Consulate.
Okay.
Because the only way you could live at High Point was either if a white person signed the lease and sublet to you.
Ah, yes.
Or if you were part of the diplomatic corps, which then made you non-black South African.
Oh, yes, yes.
So she knew a friend who wrote a document that said she worked for the consulate. Mm. And so therefore we were part of the diplomatic corps and could live and essentially go to any school we wanted.
Because you were diplomats.
Because we were diplomats and therefore non-South Africans. Mm. In fact, in 1994, because I matriculated in 93, my green ID book said non-South African.
Oh, wow.
Because that's when, I mean, you got it in matric in those days, right? Yes. That's when you got your ID. Mm. So in 93, the change hadn't yet happened.
Yes.
So my ID
it wasn't one
said
nation yet.
Non-South African. I was a trans guy.
Yes.
Imagine that.
How would you say life in Hillbro? You even lived in Soweto at some stage, right? You haven't lived in Soweto.
The first time I lived in what you would now call a township was in Soshanguve, Mabubane.
Oh, yeah, you lived in Sosha.
As a preacher.
Yes, in fact, we'll get there. How would you say living in Hillbro in those times shaped the Bongani we see now?
I'd never seen drag queens before.
Yeah.
The biggest jamboree in Hillbro was the New Year's Eve party.
Oh, yes.
Again, we're talking 1986, 87, 88, 89, those years. The 31st of December, you would see drag queens. You would see this spontaneous, it wasn't a march, but we would all be dancing around the streets. The streets were closed off. There'd be music pumped in the air. It was this racially mixed crowd. There were blacks, there were whites, there were coloreds, there were Indians. There were people from all over.
Sure.
And it was this big street jamboree. Mm. So that was the first exposure to anything of that sort. Again, the idea of living in this building where all the celebrities came. There was an artist called Jean-Michel Byron.
Okay.
He ended up being the lead singer of Toto.
Oh, wow.
In 1990, he used to perform at a club in Rosebank called Jaggers.
Yes,
and Jaggers. Every night, he would be bringing a different girl, all of them white, redheads, blonde hairs, brunettes, kissing them by the lifts.
Yeah.
I'd never seen anything like that. And I was, what, 12, 13 years old?
Sure.
It was literally as if I was living in New York.
Yeah. It was very Hollywood-esque.
That would be the equivalent of it, yeah. I mean, if there'd been a Studio 54 in Hillbro in those days, it's something I probably would have experienced.
I remember going to the first club I went to in Hillbro was, I think it was Pink Cadillac. And I was there with friends, and there's a girl at the bar that I offered to buy a drink. And I'm starting to chat her up. And then she went to the bathroom. And then the barman says to me, I hope you know that's a guy.
And how did you react to that?
The drink was off. I was like, I'm not looking to pick up a guy.
So again, the homeland system for all its weaknesses.
Yeah.
And it was the sheltered environment.
Sure.
Because we were effectively in a police state, both in South Africa and the homeland.
Mm.
There was some semblance of law and order.
Sure.
Things, the buses ran on time.
Yeah.
Things was worked. It was this bubble.
Yeah.
In
fact, you almost understand why people often say, when Mangupe ran Bop, things were better. Because things were better for a reason, because that's how the homelands were run.
There's a great book by Jacob Dlamini called Native Nostalgia.
Mm.
And it's exactly that point.
Exactly that.
There's a whole generation of people who do not look, they understand politically, they understand intellectually what 1994 meant for us as a people.
Sure.
But they also look back to all that has been lost.
Exactly.
In terms of just how a country, a state functions and what its duty is to the citizenry.
Mm.
And they look back and they say, did we go that much forward?
Absolutely. Bongani Bingwa, the pastor. What happened?
I say to people, I'm as gay as the Nile is long.
Sure.
I'm not bi.
Mm.
I'm not pan.
Mm.
I'm as gay as the Nile is long.
Mm.
I had always been in Christian churches growing up.
Sure.
I spoke in tongues. Mm. I spent much of my
You've done the whole habarabeda, dasha, dasha, dasha.
I can preach a fire and brimstone message like no other.
Are you going to do that for us?
No. I'm a little rusty now.
In fact, you used to preach on the church, on the train
We used to go on the trains. Part of the thing was, how radical could you get?
Oh, wow.
So we would preach on the trains. We would preach at Park Station. We would preach at Noord Taxi Rank. We would preach at the malls, public preaching.
So what would a typical train sermon by Bongani go like?
So remember, you've got a captive audience,
yes,
who could disappear at any time because,
sure,
you don't know when they're getting off.
Mm.
And you've got to make one point and you've got to make it land.
Oh, is that where you learned to be a seasoned radio guy? You must keep it to the point.
You've got to make your point. You've got to make it land. But you've also got to scare them.
Oh, yes.
Because there's no point.
Yeah.
You know, you're not there to teach positivity.
Sure.
You're not there to necessarily enhance. You want to tell them because this is their chance with destiny.
Sure.
If they miss this bus, if they miss this boat,
they'll burn in hell.
When eternity comes,
yeah,
whose side are they going to be standing on? Who are they going to choose?
Yeah.
And you've got to look them in the eye. You've got to find somebody that you've got to make that message land to.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, would you like to know the Lord? So all of this is a big part of me running away from, I'm a queer man. It's just something that was very, very difficult to accept.
Mm.
And I thought, if I throw myself hard enough
at the church,
at this, and I want to become an evangelist, and again, 1994 is this awakening, right, of the country, the Mandelas, the Sisulus, everything they fought for has come true.
Yes.
Who says that church can't achieve the same thing?
Mm.
People went to jail for their beliefs. What's giving up one sexuality for mine?
Exactly.
That was the thinking.
Mm.
So I ended up being a missionary and lived in Soshanguve.
So dealing with your sexuality as a child growing up, take us through that journey.
My first sexual realization, there was a stream not far from where I grew up. We used to call it a river.
Sure. As a Xhosa would.
And of course, we didn't have swimming costumes. We weren't trained. We would all go and swim a river.
A river, yeah.
And you strip down to your briefs.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew.
Yeah.
But I also instinctively knew it was something that I could not speak about.
Mm.
It was something I could not tell anyone about.
Mm.
It was my secret, and it was something that I instinctively knew had to be kept inside.
Was any of it accompanied by a guilt of sorts, perhaps?
Confusion?
Yeah.
It feels strange, but it feels familiar.
Mm.
It feels right. It feels natural.
Mm.
But it feels also very, very frightening.
Mm.
So in an environment where hypermasculinity was prized above all else, you don't speak up about that kind of thing.
Mm. Did anyone pick it up?
In standard six, we're now, of course, in Gauteng.
Sure.
By that time, in standard six, I went through a phase
where
I thought, screw it, this is what it's about.
Mm.
Still haven't had the conversation. Still haven't declared anything.
Okay, so folks haven't picked anything up.
And then I watched Dynasty.
Mm.
And this is the thing about representation I always remind people.
Mm.
Stephen Carrington was an engineer who worked on oil rigs, wore gray suits,
yes,
could punch anybody.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, that's what I'll be.
Sure.
That's who I will model myself on.
Mm.
So the conversations come much later.
When does the conversation start happening?
When it becomes evident to me that the church thing isn't working.
Okay.
I was.
So you successfully hid until the church period?
That's what I thought. Okay. I mean, I think there are many people who would say, family members, some of them, who would say, but we always knew.
Okay.
We were waiting for you to tell us. Mm. Because, I mean, of course, I was, remember also, I was the good kid. I got the good grades. Mm. I wasn't out drinking. There were no girls. Mm. So
well-spoken.
Well-spoken. Yeah. Families like that
most
kind of
most likely
thing.
To succeed.
There you go.
Yeah.
I was the deputy head boy at school.
Mm.
All of those things.
Any chance encounters with any other boys in that period? Or was it, I'm running, that's how far I'm running?
That means you have to expose yourself, you know. But we also, I mean, at one point I was at a boys-only school. And in that kind of environment, the biggest offense, at least in those days, was that you would be revealed to be this other.
Mm.
And I just was not prepared for that mockery.
You even got married.
I did. So, because again, I have to, you know.
You have to carry on this.
I have to push this thing. So I'm in my early 20s.
Yeah.
I come out of the church and I think, let's give this thing a go.
You came out of the wrong place, bro.
And then I have the conversation. I come out, I tell everyone. And then I look around me.
Mm.
And everyone, this one has been with this one, who wants that one, who's been with that one. And I thought, this is not for me.
Mm.
And I thought, let me go for it one more time. Give it a full go. I was celibate for 6 years before I met my ex-wife, trying to prove to myself that this is something I could do.
Oh, wow.
And we were part of a very radical church.
Mm.
The first time our lips met was when they said, you may kiss the bride, which in retrospect was somewhat convenient for me.
Mm.
Cue laughter.
No, sorry. I'm just, because in my mind.
It's insane, right?
No, in my mind, there's a sadness I feel that you had to walk as far as you did before you realized that actually, screw all of this.
I always wanted a family.
Yeah.
It's a big part of my identity. I'm a father now. Mm. I have one biological child.
Mm.
My ex-wife was a single mom, so my son was 6 when I met him.
Mm.
He's now a strapping lad. In fact, he's in the same industry. He's a video editor. Mm. He and I worked on a couple of Carte Blanche pieces together. Mm. So that was always something that appealed to me.
Sure.
Again, my father, because of his philandering ways, left town when I was about 6 years old, and I only saw him 3 times after that. He was dead 2 years before I even knew he was no longer around.
Mm.
So being a father was something I yearned to do, if only to fix what had gone wrong in my own childhood.
Oh, yes. So the day you decided that I'm done with this, before you try it again, what was the response around you?
We told you.
Mm.
We told you the world will eat you and spit you out.
Mm.
So come back. I was the prodigal son.
Mm.
The church community was very accepting as long as you wanted to do things the way they saw. If I walked back today, I'd bet you they'd accept me now.
Mm.
They'd love to have me, I would imagine.
That we've been waiting.
Right? Mm. Not going to happen.
How did mom respond?
Possibly one of the scariest questions my mother ever asked me was when I got married.
Mm.
And she said, but didn't you say...
It is a scary question. And we know the answer.
But she wanted the kids. She wanted the grandkids.
Mm.
She also wanted that dream.
How did your being in the closet affect your marriage, if at all?
Well, the one thing was my ex-wife knew.
Oh, so she knew.
She knew.
Okay.
She had known before.
Mm.
In fact, right very soon after we started dating, I sat her down to say, I have this big thing I need to get off our chest. This is perhaps a month into the dating aspect of the relationship. And she says, oh, yeah, I know. Because when we had started sort of getting together, she's met someone. You know how it is. You tell your friends, one of whom said to her, but isn't he? And her view was, we all had baggage. Sure. She was a single mom. If this was my cross to bear, the church would help us fix it. And that was her investment and her faith, I suppose. And to me, that made me think, gosh, somebody who would accept me even as I am, this is the one.
It's a great deal.
Yeah. So I never had to come home and say, honey, we need to talk.
Exactly. Or sneak out.
No.
So what happened with the marriage?
We lost a child. When our son died, he drowned in our pool. And when he died, there was nothing else you could take away from me. And I thought, I had to be authentically me because I had lost everything I had thought I could lose. There was, to this day, there's nothing you can take away from me that was worth more to me than that. And I thought, with the little I now have left, I have to make the most of this life. And that was the switch.
How did the conversation go?
With whom?
With your now ex-wife.
We talked. I mean, those conversations are never easy. But I suspect she knew it was going to come at some point.
Sure. Just a matter of time.
The timing was awful. And I think it's one of the things I live with. You have to remember the time period between the death of my son and the birth of my daughter was 30 days. And so initially, I'm a doer. So I'm the one, fresh, there'll never be anything more agonizing than choosing your kid's coffin.
Choose, dude. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Than choosing which part of the cemetery he must be laid in.
And not just a coffin, a tiny coffin.
He couldn't fit into a kid's coffin.
You see what I mean?
We had to get him a semi-adult casket. It was white. I remember it. I can see it in my mind's eye. This woman is almost, pregnant. She's pregnant, but she's almost at term in terms of the pregnancy. So at that point, it was, you sit there, I'll take care of everything else. Run with the show. You organize where the church service is going to be. Who is going to preach? Who is going to... All of that. I mean, of course, I had help. My sister and everybody else joined in. It wasn't a solo effort by any means. But my goal was to help her to carry to term.
Sure.
She carries to term. Child arrives. There's this sigh of relief. But she's in grief. Postnatal depression, possibly. And then I come along and say, actually. So it was a heavy moment. It was a heavy conversation. It couldn't have been anything else.
Often when a child especially dies in a drowning, the blame train is never far between a couple. How did you guys deal with that?
I don't think that's a conversation that ever happened between the two of us.
There was too much already happening, I suppose.
Also because the accident happened in a way that couldn't have been really anybody's fault.
Okay.
And so it wasn't a case of you should have, I should have, you could have, I could have. The thing that was clear to both of us, and I think she would agree with me even to this day, we went to a support group.
Sure.
They were called Compassionate Friends. And this was a support group of bereaved parents.
Sure.
And I remember sitting there listening to stories and, people would get up and say, we miss Michael, we miss Johnny, whoever it was. And they would describe how their kids had died. And there was one particular guy whose child had died in a biking accident. So this was, for us, 2009. Mm. And he stood up and he referred to something that happened in 1985.
Jeez.
And we both looked at each other and we said, this is not going to be who we are.
Mm.
We understand grief shows up in different ways for different people,
mm.
but we're not going to be stuck in this moment
mm.
that years from now, this is going to be our before and after.
Sure.
Practically, that's what it's turned out to be.
Mm.
But the idea of blaming, the mm. idea of fault finding, the idea of being stuck with it,
mm.
it's something that's irreversible.
Sure.
And you've got to, and my motto, even as a father today, I'm here for the living.
Absolutely.
I will always hold his memory dear, mm. but I'm here for the living.
Would you say, to use a biblical term, he had to pass away for you to truly start living? Or would you have found another out and started truly living?
I suspect, who knows? I might have been one of those after nine mm, husbands.
Mm.
I might have been one. I don't know if I would have had the courage.
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm.
I don't see it. Mm. So who knows? But when it happened,
mm.
that it happened,
mm.
how do you not live up to your fullest self, your fullest mm. potential, your truest self?
Mm. How do you guys then navigate the 1 million emotions that come with a divorce and want to start co-parenting?
Divorce is ugly. The
animosity that now sets in, the hatred sometimes, the anger, the I wish you were dead. No, I truly wish you were dead.
Divorce is ugly.
Mm.
It was easier to deal with the loss of my child
Jeez.
Than it was to get divorced.
Mm.
Because the one is permanent. It is immediate.
Yeah.
And there's a finality to it.
Mm.
The other is up and down.
Mm.
Because when you're married to someone, oh, honey, will you pick up the dry cleaning? Yeah. Or I've got a meeting. Please make sure you are at the soccer practice.
Mm.
All of those things you're able to cover and
sure.
back each other up.
Mm.
When you're in that space of animosity, your schedule is more important than my. I mean, mm. anything can set you
mm.
off.
Mm.
And it is a conscious and deliberate decision
mm.
to be kind to someone.
Sure.
Everything in your head, in your heart tells you not to be kind to.
Mm.
And it takes a moment.
Mm. Like I was saying to you earlier on, I feel supremely blessed that we didn't have an acrimonious divorce because I've seen how ugly it gets. I mean, I even remember my daughter, whom at the same time we were getting divorced, her friends were getting divorced, her friends' parents. I think there were about three or four in her circle of friends. And she was shocked that we were getting along because all of her friends were complaining that the parents are fighting, pulling hair out. It's just...
Look, what we did is our son at that point was about 13. So we put him in boarding school.
Mm.
So he never saw the drama.
Ah, yes.
Our daughter was very young. She was really a few months old when it happened. But I was always very clear that if I was divorcing their mother, I was certainly not divorcing them. And I have been the primary caregiver of both kids,
sure.
Even after the divorce. And yes, the acrimony was there for a while, but I think we worked through it.
Mm.
I think, I mean, to this day, my ex-wife and I can sit and with a glass of wine and 5 hours passes like 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're back to where we can
we were very quickly back to a semblance of, because
sure.
I think once the dust had settled
and
part of the reasoning was we were both young enough to start all over.
Absolutely.
I mean, she has been happily remarried 12 years now.
Mm.
She's been married longer now than she was with me, you know. And I don't think she would have it any other way.
Sure. What lessons or experiences from your personal life would you say have come in handy in your professional life?
The truth always comes out. And the truth cannot be polished.
This sounds like a carte blanche promo, but anyway, carry on.
This Sunday, no, not quite. The truth comes out. The truth, it comes out.
Yeah.
It must out. Mm. It cannot be polished. Mm. It cannot be, you can't smooth over it. Mm. It is sometimes ugly. It is sometimes messy, but it is always real. Mm. And you never have to remember it.
What would you say, speaking of carte blanche, from your carte blanche days, how would you say you personally impacted either people's lives that were the stories or just society in general? Because you guys, some would argue, are doing the Lord's work on carte blanche.
It's a very interesting dynamic if I compare the years of carte blanche, yeah, for example, to what I do now.
Sure.
And I only stopped doing carte blanche, by the way, early this year.
Yeah.
But carte blanche is a very producer-driven way of telling stories. Mm. The presenter, in a sense, is incidental. The presenter's there to connect the dots, to help you figure out what's going on. Also to kind of be your champion, ask the questions you want answers to. But ultimately, it was always very clear to me, whether we were talking to, I mean, I've had to interview bereaved parents and not make that moment about me.
Sure.
Even though their pain so deeply resonates with mine.
Mm.
I've had to sit across some of the most powerful individuals in corporates, in politics, in a number of spheres in life.
You've had to interview people that could make you disappear.
And meet them toe to toe.
Yeah.
You know, some people, of course, will obfuscate. And we're generalists.
Mm.
You know, what do I know about complicated corporate structures, you know, and deals? But I've got to talk to you at your level. Otherwise, the story makes no sense.
Mm.
But carte blanche for me was always about giving a voice to the voiceless, letting people tell stories that no one had ever asked them about before, getting people to understand that somebody cares, somebody sees, somebody will fight on your behalf.
Sure.
But also carte blanche, I mean, one of the things on my bucket list was to go and see a rocket launch. I ended up in French Guiana. You know, I mean, the experiences I would never have had.
Sure.
Being in the desert in Dubai, I'm terrified of birds, anybody will tell you. But I was able to be with
and that is not
guys
a,
who trained
it's not,
hawks.
It's not a gay joke, by the way. I'm not terrified of birds.
I was never actually terrified of birds, if you want to go there.
No, no, we know.
Of those birds, anyway. They'll much more readily trust me than you, Fresh. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, you were saying.
So it gave me opportunities. You know, you could, the proverbial, you speak with princes and paupers.
Yes.
You know, one day I'm interviewing Thabo Mbeki, the next I'm interviewing a street cleaner.
Sure.
It was just that anything goes kind of show. The very big difference between that and what I do now.
Yeah.
When I was on carte blanche, nobody knew what I thought.
Sure.
Nobody knew my politics.
Mm.
Nobody knew my ideological bent, my approach to things.
Mm.
And so, whilst I think the stories we told and they still tell on carte blanche helped to shape the country, what I do now is about opinion shaping.
Mm.
It is about making you think a little differently. It is about giving you pause. But it's also about growing and figuring things out together.
Mm. Before we leave carte blanche, what's the one story that will never leave your mind that you did on carte blanche?
There were so many.
Either most memorable or most impactful, you'll decide.
I've sat across artists asking them what their favorite song, and I've always rolled my eyes when they said, it's like choosing your favorite child, until this moment.
Yeah, who's your favorite child?
Perhaps let me say to you rather this. Mm. It's when you meet a CEO who lost their job because of an interview you did in a social setting.
Yes.
And it's awkward. Hello.
Yeah.
It wasn't personal.
Yes.
It's when you're at a jazz festival. Mm. I remember this moment particularly at the Cape Town Convention Center with those escalators going up and down. And I'm going up, Trevor Manuel's coming down. And he says, hey, Bongles. Mm. And you know that...
Why was that awkward with Trevor Manuel?
Because it was never personal. Mm. You disagree with people. It's about the issues. It's about what needs to be told. Mm. But it's never personal. Mm. And I think for me, that's something I can walk away from.
May I tell you a quick story? I remember when Tony Ngeni went to jail. We did, because we used to do a lot of political commentary on my drive show on 5FM. We used to do a lot of skits. And I think we had a whole series of skits about Tony. And then one day I go to a club in Cape Town, St. Eve's, and he's there. And he comes laughing. He's like, I heard the things you guys were doing on the radio.
And I wonder if we've moved away from that.
Yeah.
Where there was a time people understood
It
wasn't personal.
Mm.
Now, perhaps with the advent of social media and the amplification, you could do a skit on your drive show and he might hear about it. Mm. Today, if you were to do something like that, it lives beyond the moment of broadcast and it goes viral.
I listen to half the stuff we recorded on 5FM today and I'm like, how did we get away with this? Why did the SABC not pull the plug on the show?
But also because in those days, things didn't go viral. There wasn't a platform for repeating and repeating.
It was heard once and it went.
And it went away.
Yeah, and then people spoke about it at the water cooler.
And then you did the next one the next day.
Would you say there is a dangerous element to the kind of work you do? Whether on carte blanche with the exposés you did, or with speaking truth to power in what you do now on Talk Radio 702. For instance, the work you do, whether it's on 702 on carte blanche, in many other countries, you'd either need a security detail or you'd have disappeared.
There was a time Derek Watts had a bodyguard.
Yeah.
I have received...
Did Derek Watts keep bodyguard in his pocket? Because Derek was huge.
Yeah, exactly. How are you going to protect Derek? That's right. With his height.
You have to strap two guys on Derek to protect him.
I have received threats.
Yeah.
I have been sued. But again, as you say, in many other countries, people disappear.
Yes.
How many journalists have been killed around the world just in the last year? Look at the people who have died trying to tell us the truth of what's going on in Gaza. Mm. When you compare it to that, and say what you like about our political class, I've also had senior members of the ANC privately wink and say, keep at it.
Well done.
Keep at it. Mm. You know, and so say what you like about our political class across the spectrum. Mm. We are a loud, noisy place. Mm. And we're often parochial in our outlook and we think that we are the center. We think everything that is big in this moment, this week, is the biggest thing that has ever been. But the country moves on. And as the democracy matures, those things have now been set in people's minds.
Sure.
You can't go back to the days of censorship and the old SABC. There's just too much space for people to air what they think.
You can't hide the truth anymore.
The truth always out.
The threats that you got when you got them, though, what was the nature of the threats?
I know where you live.
Mm.
I know where your kids go to school.
Mm.
But often it is people who, the one particular threat was a business person.
Mm.
These aren't things from politicians.
Sure.
You know, the politicians, I mean, for you to make it anywhere near the top levels of, say, the ANC, you better know how to street fight.
Mm.
You better know how to talk your way and debate and argue your way through difficult and dense subject matter.
Mm.
A little piddly journalist telling a story about you that particular week is not going to shake you in your boots.
Mm.
But we have this thing in South Africa where the private sector are holy cows.
Yes.
We see them as people who are not corrupt.
How dare you expose me?
And yet, I mean, you know, there has to be, if there's a corrupt person, there has to be a corrupter.
Mm. So would you say it was the so-called corruptor that headed out for you?
Yeah, because the narrative, again, is that only government, only politicians, and quite often only specifically the ANC is corrupt.
Sure.
But corruption in politics is nothing unique to South Africa.
Mm.
And for any politician to be corrupted, there must be somebody who stands to benefit that we look away from.
Mm.
I haven't felt unsafe in the sense that I was not only, you know, it wasn't, the threats weren't only to me.
Sure.
They were also to the organization that I worked for.
Sure.
So, you know, those are things that in some sense you see as a badge of honor.
Mm.
You know, if everybody thought I was just some mellow teddy bear,
sure,
I'd probably be doing something wrong.
How did the lawsuit go that you...
When Weber Wenzel is representing you...
Oh, yes, yes.
And they respond...
Mm. You think twice before sending another salvo.
And I mean, I can't tell you the number of times we got urgent interdicts for stories not to be told right up on a Sunday, for example.
Oh, yes.
That's something that still happens. You know, but you carry on.
Mm.
As I say, there are far more serious things happening to journalists around the world.
Mm.
We can't be cowed by little legal letters that people write.
Mm.
And sometimes it's for stupid things.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, somebody took me to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, because I used to start my show by saying to my colleague, let's light the fire, let's kick the tires and light the fires, which is something pilots do when they take off.
Yes.
But quite often what would happen is at 6 o'clock in the morning, that's when roads are closed.
With
because
burning tires.
As people are going to work, you're throwing rocks, you're burning tires, that's when you'll get the most attention. And some listener thought, it's because I said, kick the tires and light the fires.
Yeah.
And we lost that one. But ultimately, you carry on, man.
I won Musunere and I lost my job. Like, what are the chances?
And look at you now.
We'll talk. In fact, you were asking me earlier on if I'd come back to radio. If the terms are right.
You are a legend. I know you know that, but one of the things that happens, I think, take losing your anonymity.
Okay.
You'll never get used to that. Mm. I don't care who you are.
Sure.
You know, and you experience it most profoundly when you are in a foreign country, when you're overseas, and you think, okay, finally I can melt into the crowd.
Sure.
And still there's a chacharach South African who recognizes you.
It happened to me in Thailand. I was so drunk.
You know, New York Times Square.
Yeah.
Piccadilly in Bali.
Sure.
There's always, because there's South Africans everywhere around the world.
Mm.
But for the most part, you can never get used to losing your anonymity.
Mm.
It's the strangest thing.
Sure.
Equally, I think people find it difficult to understand the significance of their impact. Yeah, you might know it in terms of, I don't know, social media following or sponsorships or, you know, brands that want to work with you. You've got a sense of it, obviously. But in terms of your influence, particularly on your peers in your industry, you don't know half of the things you have done in terms of your impact.
Thank you very much.
So thank you.
And I appreciate that. In fact, my next question was actually regarding you on radio, because I followed your career since Channel O, 25 years ago.
You were sending us texts when I was doing early breakfast on 702 2005.
Yeah.
2006.
Yeah. So I've been, like I said, watching you. But maybe I'm wrong. I think you probably sound happiest and most comfortable in what you do right now than you've ever sounded before.
There's an authenticity,
yes,
that radio forces you to have.
Sure.
Otherwise, pack up and go home.
Exactly.
I have said so many things that I had no intention of saying on the radio. But because, and especially our format, where people phone you and they confess their secrets.
Yes.
And they expose themselves. And if you can't be human, if you can't be your full self on the radio, go do something else. But I also... I'm operating at a time where many South Africans are struggling with uncertainty about what comes next. And what we try a lot to do with our show is to locate the conversations in what people are experiencing.
Yes.
We allow people to tell their story. And through those conversations, we give the audience a sense of the country. We are a real temperature gauge. So I can't depress people. And the thing that you can do in a moment of uncertainty is to allow people to be their authentic selves. And it's got to start with you.
Okay, so I'm right then. What would you say the state of South Africa is right now on this day, this week?
We are our worst critics. South Africans are almost best described as a little schizo. We can have one story dominate the news cycle and it's the worst thing that's ever happened. We win a World Cup and we're suddenly the best nation, the best country in the world.
Hugging.
So we're a nation of extremes in terms of the reaction to things.
So we're very passionate about everything.
We are passionate about everything. But we are fortunate in the sense that we live in a country where we're allowed to be ourselves. We laugh at ourselves. We cry together. We hope together. We're scared together. One day, a mall is collapsing. Partly, one suspects, because cheap labor was being used with unqualified, likely undocumented foreign nationals. In another story, a five-year-old is shot in the driveway, trying to excitedly greet his father who is being hijacked. I mean, those are the extremes we live with in South Africa. But at the same time, we've got this young Grammy Award winning artist who was the talk of town at the Met Gala. You know, that's the daily mix, you know, of South African conversations and South African stories. And I think we're in a place where I would say things are probably not as bad as they seem, but were they ever as good as we remember?
If you were called in by the ANC, advise us, what should we do different to how we've been doing things? What would you say to the ANC?
I went to a very dear friend's father's funeral. We were in the village in the back of beyond somewhere in Kofimvab. And you know, rural funerals, it's all happening within the homestead. And, you know, the service carried on as is normal. And then at the end, the MC made announcements that when they came back from burying the body, because we're all here, he says, we will then proceed with the local branch meeting of the ANC. That's one example. Perhaps the better example to illustrate my point is in the days after the Marikana massacre, we were there as a media contingent because Jacob Zuma, the president of the republic, was coming to address the families of the victims of Marikana. This is literally days after.
Still very raw.
It is raw. Emotions are heightened. And we walked into that meeting near the Kopi where it happened with no clear sense of whether there could be chaos that would erupt. Jacob Zuma had come back into the country from Mozambique. You could hear a pin drop. And he says to the audience, I thought, njengomzali, as a parent, in that way, that masterful way that really only Jacob Zuma can do, that I must come and hear what you have to say. I must come and see you for myself. But unfortunately, I have urgent government business in Mahikeng.
Yeah, he went to the Northwest.
Remember, I'm on my way to Mahikeng. And I looked around. And I thought, this is insane. What could be more urgent than what has just happened? Under your government, there wasn't a murmur of objection, of hurt, of shock. They believed him. They accepted him. His presence was enough. That's how deep and profound the love of the ANC is in South Africa. That even when people are in the depths of their grief, ANC leaders just have to show up. What would I advise them? To remember that. To stop taking it for granted. To show some humility.
Because one day it'll stop.
It will. And that dividend is fast running out, as all the polls indicate. But the feeling of wanting the ANC to succeed is still something that's a very big feature of our politics and the calculations people make when they think about who they want in power.
And you see it on a lot of these door-to-doors, that on the street, the love is still...
Just today or yesterday, there was an article, an opinion piece, where the writer was upset that the ANC is making fools of our people because there was this convoy, and I think in there was, you know, a Mercedes GLS, I think, what do you call them?
The G-Wagon.
G-Wagon. And they were throwing
T-shirts. I saw it,
and this writer is upset. But in the same article, she concedes there was a man and a woman fighting over one of these T-shirts. And when the woman lost, she then tried to catch up with the convoy because she wants a T-shirt. There's no other political brand that has that kind of currency in South Africa.
Sure.
And if the ANC were to do what it claims and put people first, they would get their majority back like that.
Advice to the DA.
Yo.
Okay, I think that's advice enough.
Yo. I've interviewed Helen Zille many a time. There is no politician with a thicker skin.
You can't tell anything.
She loves the fight. It's no accident that her book, or one of her books, is called Not Without a Fight.
Sure.
And the tragedy of it is, you can't tell them anything.
Yeah.
Because you can't tell her anything.
Absolutely.
You know, she is a prophet with honor in her own hometown.
Sure.
And there's none more dangerous.
Finally, advice to the EFF.
It almost feels arrogant to advise a party led by the most talented politician of our generation, of our time. The EFF will always have a ceiling if it maintains what it did to establish itself.
Okay.
Julius Malema and the EFF have to grow up. They have to be more than revolutionaries.
Sure.
Their youth league era is over. There has to be a sense. South Africa is a conservative place. We want to find each other.
Isn't that why maybe Juju's in suits a lot lately? And there is and has toned down even.
There is speculation. We have seen him try to reach out to different communities.
Mm.
But ultimately, South Africans come together with a leader. We want a grown-up in charge.
Mm.
We want the sense that we will be okay.
Sure.
It's the very reason black people in South Africa are so magnanimous, were in 1996 and remain so even with the levels of poverty and inequality that we have today.
Mm.
You know, it's the reason the domestic worker never smothered the kids of the bus and the madam who were abusing her.
Absolutely.
We need the grown-ups in charge.
Mm.
And the rhetoric of being radical, of being extreme, is something that will always leave you on the political fringe. Julius Malema and the EFF will always get a lot of attention.
Mm.
But until they go for that middle center,
that attention won't turn into votes.
Mm. No way.
Moving away from politics, we're wrapping up because we're out of time and apparently this episode is a tad long. And I had another hour to talk to you. How would you advise someone that has decided, screw it, I'm now starting to be true to myself and my life, as did happen with yourself, and now you need to re-enter the dating game, but as your true self now? That kind of been an easy...
What do you mean? It's the most fun I've been having for a long time.
For real?
Yeah.
So what did marriage teach you about...
I'm a relationship person, ultimately.
Lover of love.
I'm a lover of love.
Hashtag love lives here.
As many times, as many times as I have been beaten and bruised, I'm going to come back for more.
Sure.
I'm the guy who will post you.
Yeah.
We will hold hands. Sure. We will drink.
Yeah, we saw the posts.
And then they stop. Come off. Dust yourself off and you try again. We've only got one shot at this.
Yes.
You know?
And don't stop trying.
Don't stop trying.
Yeah.
Don't give up.
Mm.
Because also, for all those times it didn't work out.
Sure.
If I were to give up, then it was what was the point?
Sure.
What was the point? I'll be a lover and not a fighter till the day I die.
What do you fear, though? Because on radio, on Carte Blanche, you're this fearless journalist. You're this fearless native that starts all the trouble. What do you fear?
When I interviewed the president, he said, oh, so you're the one who talks too much.
Yeah, that native, that one.
I fear complacency.
Mm.
I fear it in my own work. I fear it for us as a country.
Mm.
South Africa has been that place where every time somebody has counted us out, every time somebody has said this is a basket case, we somehow find it in ourselves to pull together, to pull through.
Sure.
I fear that moment we run out of the proverbial nine lives because we thought we were an exception, because we got too comfortable in how many times we've come back from the brink.
Mm. So we must not stop giving a damn.
And this is why we do, why I do what I do every morning.
Mm.
By creating that space where information is shared, where views are discussed, where things are exposed, where we have accountability interviews, but we live life together. For me, the central tenet of my work is keeping myself and keeping my country honest.
And I think one of the reasons I'm an addict when it comes to your show is precisely that, that your show reminds us that we may differ in how we choose to parent or how we choose to even just, fold a shirt, if that's what it is. But your show reflects all of who we are so that we fully appreciate that the way you do things is not the only way. It's okay for other people to do things the other way too, but you must respect that. And you must actually fight to the death for their right to be different to how you are.
There was a time in South Africa where the radio talk show host had to know everything.
Exactly.
Had to be the authority on everything.
And have no opinion still.
I have the best gig in the world.
Yeah.
I get to ask dumb questions,
yeah,
ostensibly on behalf of the audience.
Yeah.
But I say to people, the best description of my job is I get paid to learn.
Absolutely.
You could be a scientist, you could be an inventor, you could be a hip hop artist, a poet, a writer. I get to ask you dumb questions. And somebody pays me for it?
Yep.
Are you kidding me?
It's a good gig. Bongs, thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thank you for having me.
Like I said, we've run out of time, unfortunately. I still have maybe we can have a part two.
I was worried what the topic was going to be. I nearly actually asked you that.
What, to send questions?
No.
Yeah.
So there's that Oprah interview.
Yes.
Where she's about to interview Mandela.
Yes.
And he says, so what are we talking about?
Mm.
And I thought, he's probably aware of that story, so maybe he'll think. But I genuinely had no idea what we would talk about.
Mm.
So thank you for having me.
No, I wanted to have people see the human side of you.
What side do they see?
They see the...
the ratchet side.
They see the guy on a pedestal. They see the well-spoken... the dictionary probably asks him for words. Radio dude. And I wanted people to see this side that you've shared with us. And thanks for being candid. Thanks for being open and honest.
I respect you too much to have been anything else.
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, Bongani Bingwa is about to leave the building so he can nap and be up for his show again the next morning as Wanda. What time do you sleep, bro?
These days, by 8 o'clock, I'm done.
Jeez.
I'm out like a light.
Like a new age John Robbie.
No, I can't.
I met John Robbie once at the chiropractor. Not chiropractor. We were at the physio. And he was telling me that he's in bed at 6 or 7.
No,
at the time.
Yeah, no.
He was like, he's in bed at 6 or 7, but at 3, he's up reading every single newspaper that is out.
Yeah. Every single day. The only time I don't pick up, and I'm talking about the physical paper.
Yes, yes.
The only day of the week I don't read a newspaper is Saturday.
Mm. Every single day.
Every single day. Sunday to Friday.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said about consistency, but we'll talk about that in the next interview. Ladies and gentlemen, wow, what an interview. We've had less than half a dozen guests, but it feels like we've covered a dozen areas. Hopefully you've picked up motivation to tackle some old things and maybe try some new things too. However, we at WOW take no responsibility for people avoiding you and your experiments with TV and radio presenting or your attempts at giving massages. Hope you have fun anyway, and hope you'll have a wow week ahead. Coming to you from AMP Studios, we're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Shout out Pezulu Works for all of the cinematography, all of the imaging by artist The Flo Fraser, and our guests today, Bongani Bingwa. Creative producer Kuvesh Mohan and show producer Keletso Modisa King. Email us at waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Till next week, have a great week in spite of yourselves.